Yeah, I apologize because I took longer than I meant to. But we now want to hear from Sarah Van Gelder, whom you met last night. So we're going to have dinner. We'll be starting dinner a little bit late. We've got a long dinner break anyway. And then do be sure after dinner to come back for the singing. Please promise you'll come and sing, and really sing, even if you think you can't. Now, I suppose I should reintroduce Sarah. I'm sure most of you know that Sarah was the editor of Yes Magazine for many years, so she doesn't need much introduction, and you also met her last night. Sarah, you're doing a PowerPoint as well, are you? Yeah. All right. Welcome, Sarah, to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Helena, and I hope your stomachs aren't growling too severely. What's the question? I need the clicker, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your attention. I know it's been a long day. I know there's a lot you have to think about, a lot of workshops you've had today. What I want to talk a little bit about is how we get the power to do the work that we need to do. Because the truth is that we know a lot about how bad things have gotten. We know about the climate crisis. We know what's going on with inequality. We know that a smaller and smaller share of the world's population now controls so much of the wealth. We know about what's going on with racial violence, where people of color continue to be victimized and excluded in large numbers. And I think people understand that these are existential problems. These are problems that really threaten to upend our way of life in this country. And they want something different. When I think about this, I think about my granddaughter. Her name is Justice. I think about what her life will be like when she's at the age where she's having children and starting to create her own future and her own family. And all of those issues will absolutely need to be taken on if she's going to have any hope of a good life. So we hear a lot about the problems, but the other thing we need to remember is that another world is possible. Arundhati Roy said it so beautifully. She said, another world is not only possible, she's on the way, and on a quiet day, if you listen very carefully, you can hear her breathe. So that's been my life work, has been to look for signs that other world is emerging and look for ways that we can bring our power to bear on making that new world a reality. So 20 years ago, I started Yes Magazine to report on the evidence that new world was coming into being, to report on it, thank you, to report on it in really practical ways. Thank you very much. Because if we're going to have hope, we need to see stories. We need to see the reality of that different world coming into being. We can't just rely on dire predictions of what will happen if it doesn't. And we can't just rely on abstractions of hope that it will. We need stories. We need to be part of the solution. We need to know how do we fit in to creating that different kind of world. So we've done issues, as you know, on all sorts of topics. But a few years ago, in 2015, I decided, after having spent many years doing those stories, that I wanted to get into parts of the country that I didn't know very well. And one of the reasons I wanted to do that is because I was getting discouraged. I was feeling like, okay, we've been telling those stories, we can see evidence that things can go much better, but on the other hand, we're still so stuck. And I started thinking, maybe there are some solutions in parts of the country that we don't see so much of. The red states, the Midwest, where the Rust Belt has been so dire, Appalachia, Native American reservations. Maybe there are places that we don't know much about where those solutions are taking hold, and especially because those may be places that have less buy-in to the status quo because they're not getting the rewards from the status quo. So I took off on a journey. If you want to see that same truck is parked right outside there. It's called Caracol, partly in honor of the Zapatistas. But I wanted to get a little tiny truck like that so that I could go into big cities or go out into Montana rangeland. Wherever I went, I could fit into a little parking spot or sleep in my truck wherever I ended up. These are some of the places that I landed. And I just want to tell you a very few stories from that trip. I don't have time for a lot, but there are a lot of stories in my book, The Revolution Where You Live, and there are more stories on my blog, which is also called revolutionwhereyoulive.org. So one of the stories took place not far from here I guess it is kind of far from here, in southeast Montana. And the reason I found out about this story, there is a plan to dig a giant coal mine, 1.2 billion tons of coal, on virgin land in southeast Montana. And the reason I found out about it was because in Bellingham, the Lummi tribe was trying to fight against a brand new coal terminal. Many of you may have heard of that, the Gateway Pacific Coal Terminal. So I was wondering, why would they suddenly need a brand new coal terminal? It would be tons and tons of capacity to send coal to Asia. Where was that coal coming from? And it turns out it would be coming from that little quiet valley in southeast Montana. So I went out there and interviewed some of the native people. I interviewed some of the ranchers. And what I heard from all of them was the same story. This is the place where I've had the honor to live, the privilege to live. This land is what supported my family for generations. And I have the responsibility to make sure that future generations also have the opportunity to live on this land, and also to have this beautiful way of life, and also to have clean water. And because of the depth of that commitment to the quality of life for the future, they were willing to do a lot of the really boring, difficult tasks that it takes to fight off a coal mine. I'm talking about reading long environmental impact statements. I'm talking about traveling to the state capitol to testify. I'm talking about working across divides between native and non-native that were not so easy to navigate. They're willing to do that hard work year after year because they had so much at stake. And when I came back after my road trip, I learned that they had prevailed. They won. Yeah, it's a great story. And you know, when I thought about what had happened, I thought, well, now they get to live the way of life that they wanted to be able to continue to live. And so these folks won, and their children and future generations won. But so did all the people along that rail line, because that coal dust would have been spewing out all over the place, including right through the city of Seattle on its way to Bellingham. By the way, the Lummi tribe also won. The Army Corps of Engineers recognized their sovereign rights to their fishing. So they won as well. And then I thought, well, what about the folks in Asia who are now going to not get that 1.2 billion tons of coal? Well, you know, they're dying from the pollution all over China and Southeast Asia from burning all that coal. So actually, they won too, because since it's not going to be such easy, cheap coal, that will help shift the economics over to renewables, as it's already starting to happen. So they won. And then I thought, well, geez, all of us won, because that's all that coal that's not going into our common atmosphere and contributing to climate change. So these little groups of relatively powerless folks, a handful of ranchers, a handful of native people, they actually, because of their deep commitment to their place and their willingness to work that hard, they were actually able to prevail in a way that's going to have climate impacts for all of us. And that really got me thinking about the power of local, as well as I am on board with the things we've been hearing about the reasons why we want to have that way of life, how much richer it is and how much better it is for our economy. But I also got to thinking about the power of local. So a new story that's coming out of these communities is about a replacing a fossil fuel dependent way of life with post-carbon ways of life. Went out to the Rust Belt and then went to, I don't have time to tell you Rust Belt stories, I don't think, but I'm going to tell you a story from Appalachia, which is another coal region where mountaintops are being routinely blown up to get more of that coal. Went to visit a place called Apple Shop, which is busy bringing back some of the beauty of Appalachian culture that's been so decimated by economic marginalization and by the way the coal industry has treated people there and all the illness that's gone with the coal mining. But the folks that are doing this have also made a commitment to bring back the beauty of the music and the art and the quilting, but not to bring back the racism. So this is actually the new executive director of Apple Shop. He's a At the time I interviewed him, he was 28 years old, African-American, named Alex Gibson. And I asked him, you know, what's it like to live in little Whitesburg, Kentucky, all white, traditionally and currently almost entirely all white? What's it like day to day? And he said, well, it's awful. He said, every interaction I have to think about how are people going to treat me when I walk into a store or just walk down the street. But then he said something else. He said, but I don't like the way that people talk about hillbillies. People talk about them, oh, they don't have indoor plumbing and their teeth are bad. And, you know, they have the right to dignity too. It's not what you see in the Beverly Hillbillies. They have the right to dignity too. And that's what I'm going to doing here at Apple Shop, is I'm standing up for everybody's dignity. I was totally impressed with him. And then I met this young woman named Ada Smith. She had decided to leave Appalachia because she was one of many young people who just didn't see an economic future. But then she started getting this feedback from people because she had her accent. People thought she was probably racist and probably homophobe. Actually, she's gay. But she got tired of all the stereotypes and all the sort of people writing off her part of the country. So she decided to go home and see what she could make of it back in Whitesburg, Kentucky. So she's one of the DJs on a radio show called Hip Hop from the Hilltop. So, you know, you might wonder, well, who's the audience for that? Apple Shop actually has this radio station, so they get lots of different programming. A lot of it's old-timey. She does hip-hop from the Hilltop. Well, it turns out that because Kentucky has a fairly powerful congressional delegation, they've been able to bring in federal money for building prisons. So one of their big economic development projects is building prisons and then bringing people in from the inner cities throughout the Rust Belt to house in these remote Kentucky hollows. And so within range of that radio show, there's like 7 prisons and jails. So that's the folks that are listening. And they got all this fan mail from people inside the prison, really grateful to get to hear this music. But then they also start getting phone calls because people, loved ones in those various cities, knew that they would be able to reach somebody inside the prison via the radio show. So they'd call out the radio show and say, could you convey to so-and-so this message? And they realized there was a real need for that. So they started recording every Monday for 2 hours. They'd leave their phone answering machine on, and anybody who wants to send a message to somebody in the prison can call up and send that message. And then for an hour every night after Hip Hop from the Hilltop, there's nothing but one message after another. You know, your niece had a baby, and everybody's okay, or, you know, we're thinking about you, keep your head up, we're waiting for you to come home. Just these very simple messages of love coming across the radio to those prisons and jails, but also all the people in those neighborhoods, those all-white neighborhoods, are hearing those same things. And Ada told me, she said, well, some of my neighbors, you know, they say, why are you doing that? But she knows exactly why she's doing that. She's doing that out of compassion and caring for the people behind bars and to help the people on the outside realize who their neighbors are. So we have a news story that replaces an extractive economy with one that nourishes our human and ecological communities. And skipping ahead, the news story is also about combating white supremacy wherever we find it. And again, as I sort of mentioned last night, a lot of times I think folks think if you're in an all-white space or mainly all-white space, well, we don't really talk about that because we wait for some people of color to come in to the space and raise it up as an issue. Well, we don't need to do that because all of us, white folks, whatever race, that's part of our challenge as well. And so seeing what Ada did with that is one of the places I got very inspired by that. So my last story for tonight is from New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey. I went to visit because they have a new mayor elected there, Mayor Ross Baraka, who came right out of the neighborhoods. He'd been a neighborhood organizer for years, started running for mayor when he was 24 years old, finally won. And to keep his promise, he said, there's 2 neighborhoods that have been neglected for many, many years, predominantly African-American communities. We're going to make sure that those neighborhoods get the investment they need until they're really on their feet. And to indicate how serious he was, he started right off with a mural project to bring beauty to the neighborhoods that he was talking about. Got to see a number of them. And this one was particularly striking. It says, we can observe the future when our vision is uplifted. And then there was this little detail I saw on another mural that I didn't really notice until I looked at the photographs later on. It says, "We the people love this place. In fact, we the people call this place our home." And I thought about this, you know, this was in one of those really beat up neighborhoods. And until then, until that trip to Newark, anytime I went to Newark, it was only because there was a flight convenient. And I try to leave city as quickly as possible. I just did not think this was a place people loved. But these neighborhoods are ones where people grew up and raised their families, and where they have that kind of deep love for where they are, and where they have that kind of commitment, just like those ranchers and native people in Montana, given the opportunity to make their place one that they will love and that their future generations will love. So that gave me a lot to think about in terms of the power to change the stories of our time when we start where we live. I came back to my little house in Suquamish. I wrote the book, The Revolution Where You Live. Most of the time, I didn't actually drive the truck from the roof, but the publishers just loved that photograph, so, you know, I went with it. But that was 4 months living in that truck, but it wasn't actually how I got her. And then I went out to Standing Rock, like Judy. I was out there reporting for Yes Magazine and reporting about some of the same things she talked about in terms of the way that love and forgiveness was so central to the work that was being done there. And it was so powerful to see a local group taking that kind of stand and then being joined by Native and non-Native people from all over the place. So powerful. And yet we saw what kind of reaction they got. We saw the kind of brutality, people being pepper sprayed, shot at, beaten, jailed, just extraordinary. And we saw that with the advent of President Trump, they lost, or you could say they lost. They lost this pipeline struggle. There's certainly a lot of pipeline struggles and other struggles that have been inspired and have now come out of that movement. So I don't think it's an all loss. And there were some extraordinary moments of cultural transformation, including the apologies that came from the veterans and the apologies that came from the religious denominations to the tribes that I think are culture shifting. So there were not all, this was not all loss, but there was some significant loss nonetheless. I happened to be out on Standing Rock when the election results came in. And I remember crawling out of my icy tent on that morning, hoping the results were going to be different. And then when I realized they weren't, I called my friends back at Yes and said, you know, I just turned in a column, but I really need to say something a little different. I really need to talk about how in times of disaster, we have to come together. We have to protect each other. We have to especially protect the most vulnerable, because President Trump has made clear the disdain he has for certain categories of people, Muslims, immigrants, women, refugees, people in the press, in the journalism business, all sorts of folks are prone to attack either by him or the people that he inspires. So the first thing we have to do is in our communities to protect each other, to step up and say, I see you there. I see you, and I'll be there for you, and will you be there for me? So it again brought home the importance of the power of local communities in really hard times. So then I got to thinking, well, I've seen so many stories of how community is powerful, how we can make change, but there's not enough of this happening. There's not enough to take on this huge system of global capitalism that is still destroying us. So I got to wondering, what will it take? What's getting in the way and what will it take? Seems like it's one of the things that's getting in the way is isolation. A lot of people feel so alone, they don't believe they have any power because they sit at home hearing the bad news and maybe watching on, you know, communicating on social media, but they don't believe they have the power to get something done. So I started thinking about the places where I'd seen community and the kind of joy that comes when people are working on projects together. Second thing that's getting in the way is the lack of skills. After the Women's March, we had 4-point-something million women and men come out for the Women's March. And then a lot of them went home and said, okay, I got it. I can't outsource my activism. I have to be part of the solution where I live. But doing stuff in your community is not always so easy. You go to meetings, and they turn out to be terrible meetings, and everybody tears their hair out. Or you end up with some one person dominating the whole thing, or some kind of conflict, and you go, oh my God, I don't like this, I'm not good at it, and I'm going to go home. So we can't afford for that to happen. We need to have skills, because it's not rocket science, but we're not born knowing how to do this either. So the third thing that I think is getting in the way is a lack of confidence. I think until now, a lot of people said, well, there are people who know how to do this stuff. They're the well-educated people. They live on the coasts. They head up NGOs. They run for office. But I'm not one of them, right? So that's the other thing that seems really important to me, is that we start showcasing who the leaders are, because they are all sorts of people. And a lot of them look just like us. So I started thinking, how can we offer this combination of the connection to overcome the isolation, the skills and the tools, so that people don't run into these difficulties they don't know how to navigate, and the role models encouragement to bring about a sense of confidence. And that's where the idea for People's Hub came from. And People's Hub is my latest project. It's a new nonprofit that we're just launching in the last couple of weeks. And the purpose is to give people an opportunity to teach and train each other in the skills they need to make change in their community. Because if that's where our power is, we need to get really good at it. We need to encourage each other. We need to be role models for each other. We need to be available to ask each other questions and to answer each other's questions. We have a pretty extraordinary group of advisors. If you go to our website, peopleshub.org, you can get to know who they are individually. But they're a wonderfully diverse group of people, all ages, all races, many of whom are some of the leading trainers in the country of how to do movement work and community work. And we've begun developing courses this weekend. We just had a weekend-long retreat to develop some of our first core curriculum. Our first one is called Dreaming and Scheming. It's about how do you, as a local group, figure out what your vision is and really know how to bring it about. So that is my pitch. I believe that the power that we need, if we're going to take on these big challenges, is actually small. It's actually deeply rooted in our community. It's actually where we live, where we have those deep connections to place and to one another. And I think we need to get really good at it. And we need to connect across all of those kinds of boundaries and lines. And I think if we can reach that kind of critical mass, where we have enough communities who are engaged, who are getting better at it, who are in connection with one another, in communication with one another, I actually think that we can see the bottom-up revolution that can overturn that system of oppression without instituting one that replaces it with yet another system of oppression. We can actually turn our society over into that new world that Arundhati Roy spoke of. Thank you very much.
Just want to say thanks very much, Sarah. This session has gone on quite a bit longer than we intended, so we're going to skip the Q&A. Anyone who's got a meal plan, better get in the line pretty quick and get your dinner. Right. Thank you.